Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome to Friday's edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is December 11th. My name is Sarah Jesmer, and I'm going to be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ganyagahaga, who are one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. I'm recording this episode of Off the Hour on Jojage, or so-called Montreal. Stay with us. We're going to be back in a minute.
C is for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K for
kitten,
cam,
C, wait, sunroof, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh, yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
First, some news. Vaccines are starting to be rolled out in the coming days to some senior citizens and healthcare workers in the province. Quebec is reporting that at least 179 people have died in the last 7 days due to COVID-19, and detention centers are also reporting spikes. New Carlisle near Gaspé is one active inmate case and 12 active inmate cases in Perse. One staff member at Bordeaux, where Montreal has COVID, and 10 staff members at Perse are actively infected. Over 35% of Quebec's detainees have been affected by COVID-19. And coalition members held a press conference on Tuesday to call for the city to ban the use of tear gas by police. The coalition is made up of more than 25 Montreal organizations and some elected officials, and they started this call back in 2019. The motion has been tabled by Snowden City Councillor Marvin Rotrand and might see a vote next week. Sharon Nelson is the vice president of the Jamaica Association of Montreal. She spoke at the press conference.
The indiscriminate nature of this of tear gas, there's just the impacts are just unending, and it's just repercussion after repercussion in the use of this banned war agent. So we strongly ask that Montreal City Council follow suit and follow these exemplary cities in the U.S. and others around the world that have already placed a moratorium or put restricted bans on the use of tear gas for crowd control.
And Thursday was International Human Rights Day. Ganigahaga community members and residents of Ganasatage near Oka marched to defend land rights on Thursday. The municipality of Oka is reportedly attempting to make the Pines a designated Quebec heritage site. The Pines are ancestral Haudenosaunee burial grounds. Land defenders say that Oka, again, is attempting to develop the Pines where they have no jurisdiction. This tension echoes the same treaty rights that began the so-called Oka crisis in the 1990s. And the City of Montreal has officially voted to pass the 2021 budget as of this afternoon's meeting. You can hear more about what changes are in it in the Montreal City website. The Defund the Police Coalition gathered yesterday after organizing all summer to ask for a 50% divestment of the police budget into other social services. Montreal will be increasing the police services budget by over $14 million next year. The province announced this morning in Cabot Square that a new intervention partnership between the Native Friendship Centre and the Montreal Police Department will start next year as well.
Hey everybody, Derek Seguin here. So we won't be hosting our families for the holidays this year, but let's look on the bright side. Got an aunt with some zany theories? Just mute her on the family video calls. A hippie cousin that bring new wave sludge to Réveillon? Not this year. To protect your family's health and safety, it's important you stay home and enjoy the peace and quiet.
Put your pants on, time to shovel the driveway!
Right away, hon. Safe holidays. Let's keep our spirits up.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
We're going to be tuning in to episode 77 from November 20th of the Warrior Life podcast with Pam Pallmatter, titled Current Issues Impacting Indigenous Peoples on Turtle Island. We'll see you at the top of the hour.
Welcome back, Warriors. Kwe Tunse Sego Anibuju. Kwe Nin Deluizi Pam Pallmatter, and I am the host of this show, The Warrior Life. This podcast is a show about living the warrior life, a lifestyle that focuses on decolonizing our minds, bodies, and spirits, while at the same time revitalizing our cultures, traditions, laws, and governing systems. And it's also about asserting living and defending our sovereignty all over Turtle Island. Today, we get to talk to Turtle Island's own political affairs correspondent. His job is much harder than other correspondents. He has to cover all of Turtle Island, Canada, the US, Mexico, and when necessary, all of the other colonial countries that continue injustices against Indigenous peoples. But we know he is up to the task. Not only is Negan Sinclair an assistant prof at the University of Manitoba in the Department of Native Studies and a prolific public speaker, he is also a well-known media commentator. He's an award-winning author and an award-winning columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. You have seen him on CBC, CTV, APTN, and most importantly, you know how big he is as a political affairs correspondent because he has been on the one and only Warrior Life podcast. And I mean, seriously, if that doesn't qualify you as Turtle Island's political affairs correspondent, I don't know what does. What do you have to say about that, Negan Sinclair?
Happy to be here again. Okay. What a gracious introduction. I've never been introduced quite like that. So, me well.
Well, you've been on here before, so I'm going to have to shake it up every time you're on here. And because you're so good at this, let's just jump right into it. So, what about this U.S. election?
Yeah, so this U.S. election, I think originally we were going to broadcast this a few weeks ago because we, you know, we weren't certain of the outcome. And for all intents and purposes, the election looked like It was going Trump's way. And in many ways, it was going the way of the Republicans, in that the Republicans performed better than anyone expected, winning major governor, senatorial races, keeping for the most part the Senate. However, that's going to be in some Georgia runoff elections. But after the mail-in ballots were counted for the next about 72 hours, 96 hours after the actual election day, which I think people aren't used to, every election works in that way. Every election has mail-in ballots that you count after the day. But most states have been uncovered, have been determined by that point. The mail-in ballots are very minimal. In the case of this, we had the most mail-in ballots of all time due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And in major states, swing states, Trump lost where he had been leading previously. And in those swing states, particularly Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, Georgia, those particular states resulted in a real significant shift. And interestingly enough, in those states in which Biden won through the mail-in ballots, those are also the states with the highest percentage of eligible Native American voters. So in the case of Arizona, eligible Native voters are about 5%. And if you see where the biggest wins for Biden, to the tune of 95% in some areas in Arizona, those were specifically indigenous areas, urban and rural, particularly amongst the Navajo. So what we're seeing is it's very likely that Native American votes got rid of Trump, or you could think of it another way, brought in Biden. Now, the history of the Democratic Party with Native Americans is not particularly a positive one. In fact, probably the best presidents that Native Americans have had is like Richard Nixon or Republicans. However, Trump has shown all signs of an all-out assault on not everyone, but also Native Americans. So here we are in a situation where I think Native people had had enough. They were more invested in Biden than Trump. Not in every state, however. In Oklahoma, for example, overwhelmingly for Trump, a huge percentage of Indigenous voters in that state as well. But that's not really a swing state. Native people really don't have as much of an impact as I think they did in Arizona.
Well, I think that's really interesting, especially because you raised Oklahoma, that as you know, this was a historic election also in terms of Native Americans in politics, because there was actually 6 Native Americans elected to Congress. And the interesting thing about it is it was 3 men and 3 women, so divided right down the middle, and 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans, again, divided right down the middle. And 2 of the Republicans came from Oklahoma. And I think what's also significant is that right now, Deborah Holland, who is from the Pueblos of Laguna, who had been elected in the last election, she's now actually being vetted by the Biden administration to potentially serve in the role as, I think it's Secretary of the Interior. So that could be another historical result from this past election.
Although, not to take away from any of the momentum, I mean, we saw with Jody Wilson-Raybould that just because an Indigenous person is within the government doesn't mean that, A, the Indigenous person agrees with the policies of the government, B, that they're able to somehow reconcile those views, and C, if there is a conflict, what inevitably tends to happen is Indigenous peoples are tossed out and then simply replaced by usually a white man, or in the case of Jody Wilson-Raybould, several different white people. And so the real problem, of course, is that when Native people are in politics, when are in government, will they be listened to? In the case of the U.S. Government, I have absolutely no optimism whatsoever that Indigenous rights will be trampled upon, pipelines projects will be approved. And particularly after the pandemic, we're looking at a major economic infrastructure agenda by both Canada and the United States, which inevitably involves Indigenous territories. Well, in fact, already involves Indigenous territories, as we see during the pandemic. All of the major resource projects that violate Indigenous rights, that don't involve consultation, have been hammered through, delivered, working at full capacity. In Manitoba, for example, here, the Manitoba Hydro kiosk generating station, as well as other, you know, projects in the north, they've all continued unabated. In fact, they were the only operating project during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they were flying in Americans. They were flying in people from international, from overseas. They're also flying in people from all across Canada, even though the borders were apparently closed.
Well, and those and are really good
can't
points.
See my air quotes there, but I meant closed, meaning not really closed.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. And I'm glad you raised that, because if you look at Canada, so on two things, the pipelines, but also on, you know, Native people in politics in general, here in Canada, that, you know, it's all talk about reconciliation and inclusion and, you know, promoting this nation to nation relationship. And when Jody Wilson-Raybould was Minister of Justice, she opposed legislation that was Native people were supporting, and then she tried to impose legislation that Native people weren't supporting. So she wasn't acting as our friend then. And you can only imagine in the US, which has a far less, you know, Native agenda or less positive Native agenda than Canada, that they'll be anything different. I will say, however, that Charisse Davids and Deborah Holland, Charisse is from the Ho-Chunk, they have both worked and brought the issue of murder to missing Indigenous women, helped bring that to the forefront during their time. So there will be bits and pieces, I think. They helped pass legislation to get more accountability on murder to missing. So I think, you know, there will be opportunities. All we can do is hope. And I'm glad you raised pipelines, because prior to Obama leaving office, he didn't approve the Keystone XL pipeline. And so that was effectively what we thought was a done deal. And then during COVID, magically, you know, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney announces, oh, we're going to resurrect the Keystone XL pipeline, put all this money into it without actually having any approvals in the US. And now that Trump's out, one of the big questions that Native Americans are asking are you going to still keep with having no Keystone XL pipeline? What are you going to do about Enbridge, you know, Line 3? What are you going to do about all of these other pipelines? Whether he will follow in the footsteps of Obama, whether he will go ahead and approve all of these things. So there's actually a lot of activism happening right now, even before Biden takes office, to kind of stop all of these pipelines. And I think that's a, you know, that's really important, because keep in mind, that's all happening while we're in the pandemic. Like you're the point that you raised around all of these projects, they were some of the only ones that got these blanket exclusions to continue with man camps, to continue with transportation inside and outside of our countries. And COVID is still raging. So now the election's over. We know Biden's going to take office. We've got all of these pending questions. But COVID is still a huge issue, right? So the Navajos helped get rid of Trump, but the Navajos are still greatly afflicted by COVID.
You sort of sped past the idea that there's still lawsuits in place with Trump. And however, those are, of course, his Twitter activism, which is the ultimate slacktivism, by the way, is probably not going to work. And Rudy Giuliani, while kicking and screaming in parking lots of landscaping firms, seems to be getting a lot of attention. It doesn't seem to be moving the courts as much. However, there are steps. Michigan, for example, yesterday, a county in Michigan with the majority Biden voters did challenge the results, the two Republican legislators there. So we are in still a struggle to get Biden to get into the Oval Office. Never mind the fact that we have another 60 plus days. Is it 90 days? I'm not sure. January 20th is when Biden's supposed to take office. And Trump is firing everybody left and right to ensure that he can do some serious damage, including pulling troops out of Afghanistan. You know, the key here is there's a potential, two potential vaccines that are coming. And the by all intents and purposes, you'll see healthcare providers get those by the end of the year. There was special permission provided this morning for one of those two vaccines. The other one is probably more effective, certainly better transportable, from Moderna. So it's likely that that vaccine, both of them will be trotted out next year. If we get 90% protection rates, Native people aren't short after healthcare workers. And governments, for the most part, are recognizing that Native peoples are most affected populations. In Canada here, I think Native peoples are at the top of the list, near the top of the list in terms of looking at the ways that we've been impacted by COVID-19. So potentially, if you are in an Indigenous community that's deeply affected, and there's many of us now, you're probably going to see a vaccine sooner rather than later. I would say before summer next year, probably in an Indigenous community, supposing that production is not interrupted, supposing that there's no problems discovering, you know, some long-term effect by one of those two vaccines. It's more likely Canadians are going to get Moderna than they're going to get Pfizer. And because of the transportability of Moderna, it doesn't have to be at sort of ice cold temperatures. But the thing that you talked about there of talking about infrastructure projects and the use of lands and resources during the pandemic, I'm deeply concerned about what's going to happen next. And the reason why is because we know the history of North American governments, Turtle Island, has always been to spend their way out of a crisis. And what that means is that infrastructure is at the top of spending for any government. That a government's saying, okay, we're going to build infrastructure to spend our way out of the crisis, create jobs, and so on. Well, what that looks like is that looks like roads, that looks like hospitals and buildings, but it most importantly looks like resource projects. And what that's going to end up looking like is projects that are defunct, that are dead, are going to be resurrected. And what I'm thinking is, as you talked about the Keystone XL pipeline, I'm talking about the projects that are somehow held up for whatever reason due to regulations or consultation. That's Coastal GasLink, that's Trans Mountain. And then projects that are long considered defunct will suddenly be resurrected, like the silica sand project here in Manitoba, which affects Manicotagan just on the east side of Lake Winnipeg. And the problem will be is that consultation will be seen as more of a hindrance than it was pre-pandemic, because it will be seen as somehow, why aren't you with the program? Hey, Indigenous peoples, don't you want jobs? Hey, Indigenous peoples, why are you so dead set against getting us to recover from the pandemic? So I think that we're in for more conflict coming out of the pandemic after a vaccine is found and then distributed. I think we're looking at a major trampling on Indigenous rights into the future, and something's got to be done about it. And as you said, activism's happening now, but I think that we're in for a bigger fight than ever coming out of this pandemic.
You know, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of where the conflict's going to originate and the problem in how the Canadian public will actually see it. So it's kind of like, you know, in the Harper years, they're very strategic at that, you know, labeling a piece of legislation First Nation Water Safety Act. And then so when chiefs and other people spoke out against it, they looked like, well, how could you be against safe water? That makes no sense. Knowing that most Canadians aren't going to read the legislation, they're not going to understand the analysis, and it's going to be the same thing here. People will have a very different mindset around the uncertainty of life, the uncertainty of jobs, the ability to provide for themselves, and potentially cling on to that conservative notion that the only jobs are those in resource extraction, and really forget about the fact that there's far more profitable and sustainable jobs in sustainable energy and, you know, addressing climate change. And, you know, there's lots of different kinds of infrastructure projects. Imagine if they spent money building, you know, water treatment plants on reserves everywhere. I mean, it's things like that, or housing for First Nations. But all, like what you're saying, has been enabled by COVID. Governments have used COVID almost as a cover. And I know you and I have talked about this before, because they actually changed laws. Different provinces and different states changed laws to allow this to happen. I mean, in the United States, you had Trump relaxing environmental laws, saying, well, we don't want to cause an undue hardship on all of these corporations trying to do extraction during COVID, as if just the nature of COVID causes undue hardship for them. And here in Canada, we've also had different provinces relaxing or making exceptions. Here in Ontario, for certain, it's happened at the federal level. And so I think you're right on a go-forward basis that this is only going to get worse, not better. And this is despite the fact that the United Nations Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination issued this year, called on Canada to issue a moratorium on all of these projects for the safety of First Nations people, and that this is a massive violation of human rights. And so Canada's not on side with the international community, at least in the, you know, human rights treaty context, certainly not on side with what how it plays out on the ground and where some of the COVID infections are coming from, literally from these projects, and what it means for the future. And we already have hotspots. I mean, there's lots of hotspots already going on in Canada and the United States.
So the bottom line of it is that coming out of the pandemic, or, you know, in the midst of the pandemic now, we just surpassed 1,000 cases on reserve as of yesterday on First Nations. And until this point, until very recently, COVID had only impacted a few communities here and there, and to the tune of a few dozen cases in Alberta and in Ontario. But for the most part, COVID had not hit, just like the Spanish flu in 1919, did not hit First Nations communities until about 6 months after it had hit major cities. So what happened during the 1919 Spanish flu is everybody dealt with the Spanish flu. There was a massive emergency situation in cities, media covered it, and then it kind of died down, and then the second wave started, and then everybody focused their attention saying, okay, we got this, we can handle this, we can, you know, have controlled openings of the economy, just like in 1919. But then boom, First Nations got hit 6 months down the line, and much more devastatingly so, because of poverty, because of lack of health infrastructure, and because of the conditions of living on reserve, lead to a outbreak moving much quicker than it does in cities. And so it's playing out exactly like 1919. We're looking at First Nations communities impacted far more, particularly in communities right now in Manitoba, with seniors facilities, particularly old age homes, long-term care facilities. And in the PAW, for example, in Opaskwayak Cree Nation, nearly 100% of the facility is hit by COVID, is infected by COVID, and there is no assistance. There is no ability to provide any assistance. The hospital is overrun in the nearby community, never mind the fact that medevacing people to the city. So what you've got here is you've got a recipe for disaster for First Nations all across the country, and you're seeing it particularly happening right now in urban spaces. So yesterday we had the youngest person in Manitoba die from COVID. Her name was Jen Sinclair. She was from Fisher River First Nation, which is right beside my community of Peguis First Nation. And she was 38. And she had been also coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, had been infected by H1N1, half a decade ago or so. Is H1N1. And we know that H1N1 rampaged through Indigenous communities as well. So her health was already compromised, and that led to her, when being infected with COVID, as dying and being the youngest person in Manitoba to die from the sickness. Unfortunately, if we don't do something soon, if something isn't done proactively, we're going to be looking at the impact of COVID-19 on Indigenous communities, urban and rural, for decades to come. And let me give you an example. During the first 3 months of the pandemic in British Columbia, there was more overdoses, even though the cases counts were very low. In Manitoba, for the first 6 months of the pandemic, needle use went up 12% on the streets. Now, I walk with a group called the Mama Bear Clan, and we're a street level first line respond group, community run, volunteer run. We walk out on Sundays. We do more walks, usually 2 to 3 times a week. But the walk that I lead or co-lead with other women is on Sunday nights. And so the thing that we provide is we provide mental health services, food, also a listening ear, and we also provide a smudge, so any sort of spiritual services for our relatives on the streets. In Manitoba, 90% of the street people, Indigenous. So what we saw was a massive upswing in mental health problems, mental health challenges. Trauma that had already been existing was now exponentially increased because people felt unsafe. There was more violence on the streets because people were more agitated. And then on top of that, all the major centers that were supporting Indigenous peoples closed their doors, like the library, like city services, like even shelters downtown were closing off because of social distancing, not being able to provide assistance. So you saw an increase in example of tent city. So the problem is that long-term mental health challenges added with a health challenge, which is now happening now, will result in more and more trauma, health determinants, challenges, and even death in Indigenous communities for long-term impacts, long-term death. And I say this with probably the saddest possible thing I can express like everything else in this country, everything else in North America, Indigenous peoples are impacted more for longer, and it results in our death when it comes to anything that happens in state governments because of this long history of violence and colonialism in our communities. And the fact is that when the vaccine becomes available, I just hope that people remember, state governments remember, that it's Indigenous peoples who have endured the most, therefore should get the most attention. But I think sometimes that's get lost in the public eye.
Well, of course it does. I mean, we're literally living in a country who is guilty of not just historic, but ongoing genocide, and who has really bizarrely and counter to the, literally in the opposite to all of the science and statistics and demographic data that's out there, used COVID as the excuse not to work on their anti-genocide plan, not to address all of the issues around kids in foster care, murdered and missing Indigenous women, the over-incarceration rates, poverty and homelessness, when in fact genocide or COVID, just the presence of COVID, knowing that it was coming and knowing what the impacts were going to be, that should have been an expedited process. Okay, how can we just rush all of this assistance to First Nations, knowing that they are only in this situation because of ongoing genocide, because of our laws and policies, and they can predict with a great degree of accuracy where it's going to hit the hardest. So if you look at Canada, and you know all of this, where are the rates of incarceration, murdered and missing, kids in foster care, homelessness and poverty the greatest? Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. And where are the COVID numbers the greatest right now? Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta for the most case. So we have advocated, like as soon as just the word COVID came out, we started advocating very strenuously at different levels of government, but directed at the ministers saying, you need to have a plan right now, a preemptive plan. You need to not only compensate for all of the lack of health care and all of the health issues and, lack of food and water and housing, you need to be addressing that, but you also need to take into account where we know it's going to hit the hardest. Wherever you've done the most amount of damage is where it's going to be hit the hardest. And they kept saying, it's not as severe. Look at the numbers. The numbers are lower. These were the responses that we were getting back. And we kept raising the point that you said, Nigan, that we know that historically and statistically, it's always delayed coming to First Nations. But when it does hit, it's exactly like you said, it's greater numbers, it lasts longer, and it does the most severe damage. And so they should have jumped to help in this situation.
Yeah, the commitments that were made, so $600 million was the famous one within the first 2 weeks of the pandemic. What that translates into is a defibrillator machine, a part-time nurse, and then a few health masks and gloves and sanitizer. That's all it really translates into, which doesn't deal with the issue, I mean, per First Nation. And that doesn't even include urban communities, which then are expected to fall under provincial guidelines, which, you know, and we know, of course, that colonialism doesn't think that way. Colonialism acts in disproportionate impacts on Indigenous peoples. The over-policing of our communities is the evidence of that. If you want to know, like, what's a symptom, what's proof that colonialism works on Indigenous peoples in urban areas? Well, over-policing. That's a perfect example. So the fact is that police only deal with Indigenous communities as problems, exactly how Indian agents treated us in the past and, you know, surveilled us and so on. So the problem has been, and I think probably this is something to give it perspective on what you just said there, the emergency situations that have been created over a century and a half of conquest and colonization of the country has been devastating for First Nations communities, been very profitable for Canada. And when an emergency is found in the past, particularly a flood, for example, or a snowstorm in Quebec, or in, you know, Manitoba, we get flooding all the time, or we get, you know, forest fires out in British Columbia, whatever it might be, there's always money. And the question is, was the country ever capable of dealing with a national emergency? And if you add up all the things you just spoke about in terms of Indigenous peoples and the impacts of colonization has been on Indigenous peoples, more people in jails, more murder missing Indigenous women and girls, more children in the child welfare system, just add it all up, you know, add up all the deaths, for example, and you would see that it is an emergency situation by any measurement whatsoever. Would a country be able to deal with a national emergency? They found hundreds of billions of dollars in a week to deal with the pandemic. And yet Indigenous peoples have been experiencing pandemics, epidemics, ongoing genocide for a century and a half. Never dealt with, drops of money, if anything, drops of attention, barely any policy that has changed all the way back to the 19th century. The Indian Act is virtually the same, with a few little things changed, tinkered with here and there. So what does that tell you? That there has been no will by any Canadian government, I don't care what political stripe, conservative, liberal, which are the only two governing parties ever. It really doesn't matter. Indigenous peoples are not deemed as the kind of emergency. And when there is an emergency, it's frankly drops in a bucket of what's needed because of the long-going, as you described, genocide, violence, systemic oppression that goes within our communities. So, I mean, the fact is, my optimism is very tempered. But, you know, I do like to, in my Anishinaabe side of me, does like to believe in the goodness of people. And every once in a while, I'm proven wrong. And I like to just hope sometimes. It keeps me from an ongoing series of despair.
No, and it's important. Like, we, all of us that are in this, of course we have hope. We wouldn't be here were it not for all of, you know, the hope and resilience and strength and determination and sacrifices of our ancestors. And we carry that forward and we'll keep carrying it forward. And part of that hope are all of the actions that we take to protect ourselves, defend ourselves. And in order to do that, we have to know what the lay of the land is. And part of the problem has always been governments have never been honest about what's really happening, who's making choices about what, because here's the thing, genocide is a choice. Like, Canada's not guilty of accidental, oops, genocide, we didn't mean for all of you people to die. It is people sitting around the cabinet table and people in higher levels of government making conscious choices to say, we're not funding First Nation water this year. We're not funding suicide prevention. We're going to continue to discriminate against First Nations children in care, knowing that we'll have higher apprehension rates. We are not going to take homeless people off the streets. We're not going to protect murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. And we're going to continue, and they can predict with a high degree of statistical certainty what is going to be the outcome of their decision. So racism is a choice. It's not an oops. And I think it's even more so with this COVID pandemic. And what concerns me is that people need to understand that you know, they keep reporting on here's who had COVID and here's who's recovered. And I'm putting recovered in air quotes because we know from all of the medical evidence that recovered might mean you don't have the COVID virus anymore, but you could now have lifelong conditions with a deteriorated lung capacity, implications on your organs, fatigue. There's like tons of evidence now coming from a multitude of countries saying that in some countries, like in Italy, about 50% 6 months after COVID aren't so-called recovered. They don't have COVID, but they now have serious symptoms that have lasted. And if you think about the already existing health conditions in First Nations, that makes this like doubly, triply, quadruply important that we prevent COVID as much as possible. And one of the things I wanted you to address on the, you know, the hopeful, more positive side of things is some of the ways in which First Nations have taken matters into their own hands, have exercised their own sovereignty and jurisdiction and self-determination to try to protect their communities.
Yeah, and just to add to what you said just a minute ago in terms of the impacts, there was a great study that was done here. I think it was here just in Manitoba, but it could also be placed nationally. It said that out of all people, blue-collar people, frontline people who are losing their jobs, Indigenous peoples are one of the highest segments, to the tune of 60% of Indigenous peoples lost their jobs. Because most of them are blue-collar workers, they're frontline workers. They're working in restaurants, they're working in healthcare, or they're working in, you know, short-term labor situations. And so, the impact of being off work for a few weeks due to the situation of just the economy shutting down has resulted in long-term impacts for those families. Because when you are hand-to-mouth, meaning you have your paycheck to paycheck, when you cut out three paychecks in a row, you're now on the streets. So we had a situation in downtown Winnipeg here of a father and a boy, a 12-year-old boy, who were living in the shelter. And that's never been seen before. We had a situation among a Bear Clan of somebody giving birth in Tent City. So these are situations that are real, and they're in situations that Indigenous peoples are at the front line. So I've been giving a few talks here and there on the situation of Indigenous peoples and what have we done in response. And what I've said is that pandemics are not new to us. Epidemics are not new to us. In fact, our creation stories talk about epidemics and how we dealt with them. We had quarantine measures in our traditional stories. We knew how to deal with sickness. You know, alcoholism is a sickness. Smallpox was a sickness. And even today, you know, violence is a sickness in our community. We know sickness very well, and we know how to deal with it too. We have our, whether it be restorative justice, or whether it be the traditional medicines that we have, or whether it be the very practices that we have within our communities of how to deal with sickness, we have all of that. And some of the most amazing things happened during this pandemic within communities that I know of or that I'm connected with here in Manitoba. People were going out on medicine collecting missions. They were going out as grandmothers often would be leading the walks. They would collect medicines, antibacterial agents for the air, sage, sweetgrass, bear root, things that we collect and we use to clean houses, to get rid of the bacteria in the air. And then what they were doing is they were distributing them throughout the community, just like how people collect moose or they hunt moose and then distribute that throughout the community. People also were doing social media campaigns, hashtag. There was actually a pretty cool set of videos of people doing socially distanced dance-offs at the First Nations blockades here in Manitoba, saying, hey, I challenge those at Cross Lake. Hey, I challenge those at Fisher River to do a dance-off the way we're doing it. And they were doing, you know, line dancing or, you know, and then there was also some really great stuff that was being done in urban communities here in the city. So one of the things that was being done by, you know, organizations, people were doing clothing drives, people were doing healthcare. One of the things that happened is some of the grants that people were able to access through community organizations resulted in people being able to provide masks and sanitizer for those downtown. So during the Mama Bear Clan, for example, we were giving out, we still are giving out, tens of thousands of masks and sanitizer to people in Tent City. And we're able to do that because of the tremendous generosity of Winnipeggers, but also the fact is that we have people donating, people, you know, people like myself, others who are going out and collecting in our garages and bringing stuff to the Mama Bear Clan upon waiting the 2 weeks necessary to make sure that it's clean, that it's sanitized properly. So the remarkable thing about Indigenous communities is while we are the most hit, we are perhaps the most equipped to be able to deal with sickness because we've been doing it for tens of thousands of years. So we know the teaching is, the basic, very simple teaching is, during a pandemic, we are, the society, mainstream world is encouraging us all to turn away from one another, forget about one another, to go to your house and just don't worry about it, we'll take care of it. That's individualism gone amok. Our communities are about turning together, turning socially distance, of course, taking care of each other in terms of health, but we have to turn, we have to come together at this time. We have to commit more to one another. Our gifts have to be given more than ever to one another, not less than ever. So I think if we realize that the solution to this pandemic will be in how we commit to one another, and you see that with the mask campaign, wear a mask to help someone else. That's the basics of our teachings, is of course you would wear a mask because you love your relative across the street. You would want to be wearing your mask more to commit to that person. That's your gift. Just like when we offer tobacco, we do that to build a relationship. We don't do it because we're, you know, paying somebody off. We're doing it because we're building a relationship. And so this pandemic, I think Indigenous peoples may be the ones, as I've said, you know, many things, tech from technology to the environment, Indigenous peoples be the ones leading the way, we'd be much better off.
Exactly. And I think that just goes in line with how First Nations actually responded to the pandemic. There was no question that for those who were next to urban areas or other areas of vulnerability, they closed their borders and they enforced it. Whether or not they had their own policing force or security force or whatever, people manned those lines to make sure that there would be no spread of COVID from, you know, local communities, for example, and they started passing their own laws on the reserve and saying, here's how we're going to handle this pandemic, or they started making their own proclamations. They started forming alternative governance structures to have, you know, emergency committees, started coordinating and collaborating with other First Nations. And I'm also talking about Native Americans too here. So Native American tribal governments, coming together. So you would see some of them come together in a whole bunch of numbers so that they could order PPE in mass quantities and be able to share it. And those who had extra were actually helping other First Nations. So you saw First Nations exercising their sovereignty and jurisdiction and responsibilities quite outside of asking permission of, you know, federal or state governments, federal or provincial governments here in Canada. And I think that's one of the things that we need to take going forward, that, you know, even without the money, even without the infrastructure, even with all the difficulties, that our best path forward is always when we're taking care of ourselves. And like what you said, community, I mean, community is what changes it all. To think that we would all just go hide in our homes, what about the elders? What about people who are ill? What about people with disabilities? What about people who need to go back and forth to appointments? What about kids that are stuck in a foster care situation during a pandemic? And to see all of these people, like all of our brothers and sisters all over the country saying, well, you know, I'm home now, so I'm going to be the one to deliver meals to all of these elders, or even just checking on them. You know, like none of that stuff gets any, you know, media fame or attention, but it's who we are as a community for all the ways in which we've been colonized and traumatized and all of the negative impacts of that. I think one of the hopeful things is actually seeing that, you know, within the communities and then online, you see like thousands of Canadians tuning in to Indigenous teach-ins about how to address COVID. So it's not just within us that we're helping to educate and empower and take action on COVID, but it's also other Canadians who are saying, well, yeah, you know, I have to look outside of my own house and look at my community, even if they don't even know their neighbors. How can they do that? And I think it's also empowered Canadians to think about government, using quotes again, differently. That in fact, the people are the government first and foremost. Who they elect are, you know, just spokespeople. But I think, you know, going forward, we really need to focus on the ways in which we have the power and we have the teachings, we have the knowledge on how to take care of one another, because we know governments are only going to do what they're forced to do. And I think it's going to be even more important in the months to come, even when they say COVID numbers have gone back down. What are the long-term impacts, like you said, economically, but also health-wise, socially, culturally? Because if we look at the First Nation charts right now, and you've seen it, it's like a straight almost a straight diagonal line up with no signs of stopping. And we know what that's going to mean. So it's even more important that we come together now. And Mama Bear Clan is one of those ones that is actually helping people on the ground. And you don't need government permission to do that.
Certainly could use government support, though. And we were able to get due to some of the COVID funding. It's important to identify, you know, we were able to apply for and get a vehicle for the first time in our organization's history. So there was money that did reach people that are impacting everyday lives. I was going to tell a story here. I have a non-Indigenous friend, and everyone's got to have one. I'm just joking. But it's joking. Anyway, I have a very close non-Indigenous friend of mine. I grew up rural Manitoba. So, you know, I grew up in Selkirk, Manitoba. Frankly, it's a very conservative town, used to vote for the Canadian Alliance. Anyways, so many of the people I know growing up are quite right wing. And these are people who, part of my family, for example, part of my people who I call uncle and auntie, even though they are hardcore Harper supporters, formerly Stockwell Day Canadian Alliance. Anyways. In that group, one of my friends, growing up.
and we're always doing it under the concept of being scorned at, or, you know, looked down at, or, you know, considered as radicals and whatever else the government wants to call it.
Same thing for when we march for pipelines. Same thing when we talk about committing to the earth and saying, maybe we shouldn't build that mine. Maybe we should think about how we're polluting the air and the earth and the water. We're doing that not just for ourselves, we're doing it for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you raised that second part, because there are some hot spots right now in Canada, and I'm calling them hot spots because there are significant risks to Indigenous people. So, you know, in Mi'kma'ki, in my home territory, the extended racist violence and intimidation and property destruction and criminality, essentially terrorism happening against Mi'kmaq people, literally while fisheries officers and RCMP stand by and watch. You have here in Ontario, all of the Haudenosaunee at 1492 Landback Lane, who have been peacefully reoccupying their territory, which is clearly theirs. There's no, you know,
there's no gray area there.
Yeah, there's no gray area. I mean, the Haldimand Tract was given to Six Nations. It's theirs. It's been wrongfully taken away. And they've, you know, had to suffer through being called terrorists and tons of arrests. I think they're well over 40 arrests now, injunctions, fines against them, OPP violence. In Shikwetmik territory, you have land defenders who are, you know, been to court and have to go to court again for having peacefully defended the lands from Trans Mountain Pipeline. In Wet'suwet'en territory, things are ramping up again. Another potential RCMP invasion is imminent, where they're trying to defend peacefully their territories from Coastal GasLink Pipeline. And this is all happening under the context of COVID. And, you know, you kind of get the sense that all these law enforcement agencies, federal and provincial governments, are taking advantage of the fact that the attention is all on COVID right now, and that they can take these actions and inactions that threaten everybody's lives. Because like you said, when we defend the waters against pipelines, which always leak and always do damage, there's no question about that, we're doing that for everyone. But it seems to kind of go a little bit under the radar. But I feel like on a go-forward basis, these hotspots are going to be, you know, a situation of conflict and risk for Indigenous peoples, unless Canadians can actually continue to get on board and push their governments.
And also be aware that Indigenous peoples are probably the best ally in taking care of their children.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, when I make that blanket statement, I don't mean, you know, there are Indigenous peoples who are very pro-capitalist and pro-pipeline. And in fact, one came up on my Facebook this morning, and I was like, just blown away by the gymnastics you have to do in your head to go to the lodge and to also be pro resource development or resource extraction. And frankly, just the destruction of Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea that you can still go to the lodge and lay your tobacco down. I don't know how you can do the gymnastics in your head. I'd sure like to see how somebody figures that out in a traditional way, in trying to figure out how do you live ethically. But you're talking about going forward here. Mm-hmm. Going forward, I think it's an optimistic time for probably the first time at the pandemic. What I was saying to people yesterday was, now that there is a vaccine potentially in sight, it means that this darkness, this arguably a time that nobody prepared for, is one of the most stressful and difficult times in, I think, human history. We can see the end of it, the potential end to it.
You've been listening to the Warrior Life podcast with Pam Pallmatter from November 20th. If you want to listen to the rest of this episode, you can find it on Pam Pallmatter's website, www.pampallmatter.com. You're listening to CKUT.
Time.
C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Fanrofe.
Thank you. raison de pandémie, CKUT a décidé de rapporter indéfinie notre campagne de financement annuelle. Mais nous apprécions toujours les dons pour soutenir nos opérations durant la fermeture. Le moment présent exige des nouvelles approches créatives, et des douzaines d'animateurs et animatrices ont relevé le défi en maîtrisant les logiciels pour vous livrer les émissions de très haute qualité. Nous sommes conscientes que CKUT 90.3 FM vous tient à cœur. C'est pour cette raison que nous faisons appel à votre générosité. Si votre situation vous le permet, nous vous invitons de vous rendre sur notre site web ckut.ca et de faire un don en appuyant sur le bouton vert de donation ou d'envoyer un chèque par la poste à Radio CKUT 3647 rue Université H3A2B3 Montréal, Québec. Merci.
Pour lutter contre la COVID-19, on doit tous respecter les consignes d'isolement de la santé publique jusqu'au bout. Quand on a des symptômes, on doit s'isoler. Quand on a passé un test, on doit s'isoler. Quand le résultat est positif, on doit s'isoler. Quand on revient de voyage, on doit s'isoler. Et si on a été en contact avec un cas confirmé, on doit s'isoler. S'isoler, c'est sérieux. S'il vous plaît, faites-le. Informations sur québec.ca/isolement. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Bonsoir à tous. Bienvenue sur Café, votre émission d'art et